Welcome back to The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management. As advisors to some of the wealthiest families in the country, The Rate of Change is a podcast designed to help you in the pursuit of building long-term wealth through the insights of some of the brightest minds in asset management. I'm your host, Murdoch Gaddy, and in today's rockcast, we're joined by Michael Goldberg, co-founder, managing director, and portfolio manager at Collins Street Asset Management. Michael's flagship fund, the Collins Street Value Fund, has returned 14.85% over the past 12 months and averaged 13.5% per annum since inception in 2016. His background, shaped by early lessons in his family's business in the rag trade and his unconventional path into finance, brings a very fresh perspective on identifying deep value opportunities in the Australian share market. In this rockcast, Michael and I get into things. He dives into their core principles for value investing. We'll explore how Collins Street goes beyond conventional methods, refusing to rely solely on consensus data. Instead, combined with consensus data, they take a more hands-on approach, testing products themselves, asking family members, you know, if they like the product, like Meyer, David Jones, calling companies with his daughter to gain a unique insights, during COVID times when you're locked in, and even hiring on the ground contractors to investigate factors like potential radioactive material fallout from a rumored nuclear submarine incident nearby that may impact one of the companies they're holding. Michael also highlights their unique mentor buddy system where investment ideas are rigorously debated and stress tested and steel manned. These strategies combined with a disciplined focus on long-term outcomes have helped the fund uncover opportunities others may often miss. We'll dive into case studies, including past and current positions in Metcash, ResMed, Ramelius Resources, while exploring opportunities across sectors like gold, energy, consumer staples. So before we get into the conversation, please remember this rockcast is made for entertainment purposes only. I encourage you to listen to the disclaimer at the end of the rockcast and keep your feedback coming. You can reach me at mgatti@ywm.com.au. With that being said, I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Michael Goldberg, welcome to The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management.
Thanks for having me, Murdoch. Appreciate the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
Michael, why don't we kick things off as we always do and tell everyone a little bit about yourself and how you got into finance.
Yeah, not fair enough. I suppose I'm a Melbourne boy, born and bred. I grew up in a Jewish community, went to a Jewish private school for primary school. Eventually made my way across to Corfu Grammar, where I graduated. I didn't take the ordinary route through education into funds management. Instead, I decided to take a gap year overseas and study for a year in seminary. 1 year turned into two, turned into three, and eventually I was there on and off around my university studies for about 4 or 5 years. So a bit of a different approach, but a really good opportunity to, I suppose, get out in the wider world, experience some different culture, experience some different people, and get some life experience, which I think made a big difference for when I did eventually come back and get my job and start investing in equities in a professional sense. That was certainly an interesting journey. In terms of my interest in business and my interest in equities, I mean, I think that goes all the way back. You know, my grandparents essentially came from Europe with nothing but the shirt on their back, a righteous work ethic, and a drive for entrepreneurialism. And I think that certainly translated across to my dad and his brothers and sisters, and then on to us. You know, I remember from the earliest days, dad would take us with him when he would go and do the shopping for his small retail empire. I would come along with him and watch him negotiate, the purchase of whatever costumes or outfits or whatever it was he's buying at the time. And that was a wonderful experience. You know, when he wasn't coaching us during the winter in our soccer team, he'd drag us along, sometimes willingly, sometimes kicking and screaming, to help out in the Queen Vic market where he ran a stall for probably 30 or 40 years. Some of my fondest memories are quote-unquote helping him at the Queen Vic market. But in terms of equity specifically, I think probably my first experience was a bar mitzvah present from one of my aunts. She bought me, I think it was $100 worth of CSR shares back in the 90s. And from then on, the only sugar mum was allowed to buy in the supermarket was CSR sugar. And while I didn't really know how businesses worked, how equities worked, there was sort of, I suppose, the beginnings of a planting of a seed, you know, the concept of owning a great Australian business. Whether CSR was a great Australian business at the time is potentially a debate for another time. But certainly the way I felt was that I owned a part of this wonderful, recognisable Aussie company. Shortly thereafter, my other auntie actually put me in touch with her stockbroker. And back in the day, it was a full-service stockbroker. It wasn't like nowadays where you jump online, yeah, you click your way through and decide you're going to pick what you're going to pick based on whatever tip you heard or whatever article you read. Back then, you got some personal attention from a stockbroker, and then you paid well for that personal attention. But I remember walking away from this conversation. We probably had a half an hour chat. Again, me, a 13, 14-year-old kid talking to a broker. And I walked away thinking, jeebus, you know, this guy really has a deep insight into this business. And the business that we ended up buying was National Australia Bank. Surely there must be some way to take this information advantage that this guy has and turn it into a long-term plan for profitability. Again, I didn't exactly know what to do with it. I didn't connect the dots at that point, but I certainly went away already having established an interest in business through my dad and his entrepreneurship, realizing that there was something to be said about owning and buying public listed stocks. And surely there was a way to take this information advantage and leverage it into, you know, a way to make returns. Now, I grew up and came through through the university system at about the same time that CommSec and E-Trade and the discount brokers did. And I think after having gone through my studies at Monash University, I was resigned to the fact that I would probably be a disgruntled back office worker in some large bank somewhere, and was thrilled as I could possibly be when I finally found my first professional job working for a small boutique wealth management firm called Leyland Private Asset Management, who essentially did exactly what I was looking for. You know, now with the benefit of hindsight and some experience, I recognize now that what I imagined stockbroking was not actually what stockbroking was, but the job that I found was right in line with what I was after. You know, essentially our role was to build relationships with clients, build a tailor-made portfolio for those clients, and then manage that portfolio going forwards. So that's I suppose where I kicked off. That's where I started. You know, I worked at Leyland for about 8 years, where I met my now business partner. Subsequently, we both decided that we wanted to take our business to the next level. We recognized that, you know, perhaps we weren't the best party to do every part of the funds management business. You know, we felt we were very good at certainly picking stocks and managing a portfolio. But we thought that if we could get economies of scale, potentially we could bring in people to do the bits of the business that we weren't as good at. So, for instance, sales. We launched the company almost 10 years ago now. We opened it to the public for investment about 9 years ago. And now we find ourselves here with Collins Street Asset Management, our flagship fund being the Collins Street Value Fund. It's done pretty well over the journey. I think we're running at around about 14% since inception, which I think puts us somewhere between 4 and 5% better than what the broader market has done. So it's been a journey. It's certainly been a journey. It's been fun. It's been frightening. It's been fulfilling. And we're very proud of what we've been able to achieve so far.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting journey you've had. I've always found it as well. Like, you know, when I was coming up and as a broker at one of these, you know, houses, a lot's changed, hasn't it? But it's just, I say it every single time. I find some of the most interesting people in finance never had a straight path into finance. And wouldn't you agree that, you know, it's the people that kind of went out and then came in, what they actually got was perspective from a different light. And what's interesting is you mentioned, like, you know, the religious side of things. Like, I went to Joey's, which is, you know, very much a Marist, you know, Christian-based school, but the Jewish school, or whatever religion it is. What's so interesting there is you've looked back thousands of years. What it really is how do you essentially govern a culture, right? You know, what do you put in place as a means of, you know, how do you behave? How do you do things? How do you perform society? How do you communicate, you know, within your peers? What are the rules, you know, available to essentially dictate, you know, how we do trade, how we do business, right? And I just find it very interesting that you went the seminary path you know, especially from coming. And the other thing which I find very interesting, we're both families of immigrants. My family is Hungarian, Italian. My wife's Greek. But what I've noticed is if you look at many families which we run money from, a lot everyone comes across, but they all tend to stay incredibly tight and strong together, have their own business, right? And then they weren't the best things for the kids. Back then it was universities that kind of pushed through. But what's interesting now is how over numerous years that position kind of changes a little bit, right? And they push so much about, no, don't work for the family business, go get a job, you know, be the best individual, right? And then you have a household of individuals, right? And maybe that's the Netflix model, as in, you know, if you split a family 10 different ways, there's 10 different rents, 10 different Netflix accounts. You know, what's so interesting now is after the COVID times, the families, I'm starting to realize, maybe you are as well, or maybe you're seeing the pattern, families are starting to come back, be tighter together. They're now starting to ask questions like, you know, if I have my own family business, you know, what does that mean? Can I employ the children? You know, can I help them get, you know, assets? Can I help them build their portfolios? It's just very interesting to hear your journey about how you went through, and then looking at, you know, young kids today looking to get into our industries, you know, ask yourself a question, should I go stockbroking path? And that's the other reason I like getting yourself on, Michael. I like speaking to portfolio managers, but I really, really enjoy speaking to people like yourself who actually look after the business, so to speak, because it's such an interesting perspective on how it works. So I suppose in that rambling sentence, my main question is, you know, how did...
touched on a lot of topics just then.
Yeah, so yeah, no, it's fun, mate. We can have a whole conversation based on about the 15 things we got on, but I suppose how about we start with the philosophy, right? So how did essentially, you mentioned, you know, your family business, you mentioned joining the seminary and then liking the investment. How did essentially that create the foundation for the investment philosophy of Collins Street?
Look, I mean, I think the starting point is the culture of support from the family is of utmost importance, you know, and one of the conversations I've heard come up quite a lot recently when I've spent some time on the road is I've met some heads of family offices who broached the question, how do we get our kids and our grandkids to come and be a part of the business? And I always found that to be an interesting question because, you know, I come from a fairly large family myself. I'm from a family of six. I'm the eldest of six. And the idea that my brother who ended up becoming a chippy or my brother that ended up working in health science would be a good fit in the same way that I might be a good fit for a clothing retail empire is just a really strange concept to me. And what I found from my grandparents and then subsequently from my parents was that they were highly supportive of us pursuing whatever we wanted to pursue. And, you know, in our younger years, if that meant trying out, you know, little cute and interesting ways to make money, then they were supportive of that. You know, I remember in school, I used to leverage my dad's connections and would sell Michael Jordan t-shirts at lunchtime to my mates. You know, I remember, you know, buying boxes of basketball cards when basketball cards were all a rage in the early and mid 1990s. I might be aging myself a little bit here, and, you know, going in on a couple of boxes with the mates and then selling them to other mates for a discount for them as well, but a premium to what we had paid. You know, I still recall with a little bit of delight, perhaps my first ever investment was an arbitrage investment. This is a little bit on a tangent here. I apologize. You can drag me back in if you want.
The whole point of these long format conversations is the tangents are the most enjoyable part. We'll get back to finance later.
Perhaps my best ever return on investment on an IRR basis was as a 13 or 14 year old kid. I was at my mate's house and we were, you know, mucking around, driving around town on our bicycles, trying to find something to do. And we found ourselves headed towards a $2 shop, which in those days was a new concept. And both he and I were mad keen sports fans and we collected footy cards and cricket cards and basketball cards and whatever it may be. And we went into this $2 shop and we found they were selling boxes of cricket cards for $2 for a box. And we thought to ourselves, well, hang on a second, you know, let's smash open our piggy banks. We know that a set of cricket cards goes for well more than $2 per, you know, per $2 per set. Let's buy a couple of boxes, whatever we can. We'll make some sets and we'll ride our bikes down to the collector card store down the road and we'll see what we can get for these things. So I think we had $4 to start off with between us. Back in those days, for your millennial listeners, $4 could go a long, long way. So we bought a couple of boxes of cricket cards. We took them home. We broke them up to sets. I think we got 6 or 8 sets. We took them to the cricket card, to the card shop, and we were able to sell each set for $9. So you know, we made a significant return in not a significant amount of time. So the guy paid us our $9 per set. We went back with our now $20-$30 and bought whatever was left in the $2 shop and came back and tried to do it again. The owner of the shop was less inclined to pay the full $9 per set the second time around. He asked us what we were up to, and I think he paid us $4 or $6 per set. But you know, the idea being that if all you see money as is an opportunity to buy, you know, the next lolly or the next packet of cards or whatever your next outing might be, I think that you limit yourself to the opportunities. Whereas my upbringing, watching my dad run his business, sort of gave us a sense that money can be leveraged, that money can be an investment, that money is capital, not just something that you used to sell. And passing on that lesson to my kids is varying degrees of difficulty. My elder kids have certainly taken that on board. My younger kids, not at all. And to be fair, you know, apart from the educational aspect of teaching kids about the, you know, cash as capital, I'm not sure that it makes a ton of sense for kids to be saving. Again, aside from the benefits of education. So, yeah, look, I mean, I was fortunate to grow up in that environment. It wasn't always roses. Certainly the family went through a lot of challenges during the 1990s recession we had to have. You learn lessons in good times and you learn lessons in bad times as well. You know, one of the lessons you learn in bad times is the importance of being close to your family. And certainly my father and his siblings have always been very, very close. And during the tough times to get their support was, you know, the value was immeasurable. And similarly, my siblings and I, we fought like you wouldn't believe as children, but growing up, we grew up very, very close. And again, our support for each other and the way that we are there for each other is as important as anything. So, you know, while I'm certainly hopeful that I can pass on the financial lessons to the next generation, I think as important is passing on those into family relationships, the lessons of how important it is to have community, to have family, and to support one another. Again, this is a massive tangent. I'm not even sure how we quite got here, but, you know.
No, but this is actually quite important. Like, you know, we'll get into Collins Street, but I'm just, this conversation is to understand how you think, Michael, right? You know, and you know, why do people, you know, seek to invest and what should they be doing? Because there's probably a lot of families out there. I think, let me say it a bit differently. A lot of my clients, a lot of the fund managers I deal with, a lot of the wealthy families, the very wealthy families we deal with, they're actually saying that the number one most important topic is not making an extra 1 or 3 or 5% and, you know, should I buy the next NVIDIA shares? The question they're asking is, how do I help my family, my descendants, my grandkids, without in turning them, excuse my French, into entitled little brats, right? Which, you know, we're seeing right now. And I think my father was a banker for 20-something years at NAB, and he always had an expression, the first generation makes it, the second generation manages it, and the third generation loses it. And ask yourself a question, you know, why is that a saying within the banks? And I pondered that for years, so much so I wrote an article and I went and researched essentially the like old school families, which is completely different. And now if you look at the Vanderbilts and the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and what we learned from that study was the Rothschilds, like many families, would create trusts and then essentially give money to the children. Meanwhile, the other families, and this isn't just very, very large families. There's a lot of other families have a similar mandate. They created like a family bank kind of perspective. Mm. And what they did, they didn't give any money at all, but then they had an emphasis on starting financial education, which is outlawed in Australia, like at the age of 12. And what they mean by that, anyone listening, I highly recommend that, you know, if you have a community around you across all services, lawyers, taxes, you know, mortgage brokers, you know, whoever it is, your mates, right? Drag your kid along when you go see the accountant or whatever it is. They might hate you for it and they might sit in the corner and just be like, and no iPhone. But they learn that at this time of year, this is just part of the process. And when they get older, they learn through osmosis, they kind of hear what's going on and it just becomes part of the process. Wouldn't you agree? And the other point I make on that as well is then these young people, your family's connections become your connections. Right. And the other thing which they learned with behavioral psychology is human beings, as you mentioned with your family, you might not want to go into the rag trade, even though that's the family business, but you want an opportunity and your family wants to support you in the opportunity which you choose. So the question becomes, why can some people take that opportunity and not take that opportunity? 9 times out of 10, it comes access to cheap capital. Right. So the problem is, if you don't have assets which you can go to a bank and borrow from, which is the reason I've done a whole lot of podcasts and speaking with a whole lot of private lenders. The whole industry of private lending has boomed because you can't get access from particular institutions. But if you can, instead of borrow money at 12, go to the family and potentially get cash, you know, the cash rate, because it's just a fair loan, you could potentially help the family, you know, earn together, you know, find the cards at $2, which is probably now $20, you know, and sell them for $100, right? You know, find that arbitrage, or, you know, seek an opportunity, you know, be a mining transaction or a property transaction, right? But what's great about that, you spent 5 or 6 years as a kid understanding the process. And then what happens is you build that pitch deck with, it could be a SaaS company, it could be a brand new tech company. You might have figured out a brand new way to bring medical devices, whatever it is. But then you've go on the actual process, which is the right way to do it. And then you take that deal back to the family. The family might not have the money, but their network may have the money, and then they help you go get that. And if you want to buy that Ferrari, then you figure out how much the Ferrari costs and what profit margin you need out of the entire deal. Do that transaction. And in 2 years' time, you've got the capital to go buy that house, buy that Ferrari, right? Or build that family business. And I think that's what you and I are discussing right now, how, you know, how the question becomes, which we're speaking to a lot of our clients, is how do you help the family, you know, educate the kids to give them the skills that they need to do well in this life? And, yeah. And by the sound of it, Michael, you're doing the same thing with yourself, your own family, and at Collins Street.
I mean, look, we certainly try. I think the point that you're making, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the point you're making is that all things being equal, if you've got access to capital, your opportunity set is much, much wider. But I would say it starts before that. I think it starts at first education, and then secondly, having that, you know, in footy we call it the mongrel spirit. You know, I've got two boys who both love playing footy. One of them has an unhealthy disregard for his own well-being, and the other one has a sensible regard for his own well-being. And it's the kid with the mongrel spirit that makes a big difference on the footy field. And I think to some degree, what you might see across two or three generations is a losing of that mongrel spirit. And so, you know, part of that comes back to education. Part of that comes down to expectations. But, you know, as an example with my kids, when they were keen to invest their own bar and bus mitzvah money, I've got kids from 18 down to 8. So when my now 15-year-old and now 18-year-olds wanted to invest their money for the future, again, we can have another conversation later about, you know, their own internal rate of inflation versus what they can hope to achieve through investing in equities. That's a conversation for another day. But they were keen, and the education value is there. And so when they first came to me, they said, hey, Dad, you know, we'd like to invest in your fund. And I said, no, that's not how this is going to go down. I said, you know, you've got to understand what you're doing. You've got to understand the businesses that you're investing in. And you've got to come to understand the process, both of buying and then eventually of voting or trading or selling or exchanging. And so, you know, rather than just picking a few stocks for them, rather than just having them come on board with our fund, instead what I did was I picked out 20 companies from the ASX top 50, and I sat down with the kids and I said, kids, it's your job to do research on these stocks. And between you, you guys can pick 4 or 5 stocks and we'll buy you a portfolio that you guys can share, that you guys can co-invest in. And so we spent, you know, a day sitting down where they would jump online and I'd give them some guidance and explain to them what a PE meant and explain to them what a return on investment meant and what a dividend was and what franking credits were. And they picked some stocks based on what interested them. I was quite surprised in what they ended up picking. I'm pleasantly surprised. The performance hasn't been great. They would have been better off investing in my fund. But the experience is invaluable. I mean, you know, now when we get their dividend statements or their voting forms from, you know, CSL or from Incitec Pivot or Woodside Petroleum, you know, like, Dad, what does this mean? I say, well, read it. You tell me what you think it means, and then we'll have the conversation. You know, certainly to your point, Murdoch, it is a massive leg up if you've got access to capital and access to networks. Not everyone has access to that, but everybody does have access to the way they view the world and to adjust the way they view the world and the education that they can pursue. Again, not everyone's going to get the opportunity to go to private schools like you and I might have, but libraries are free. You can read whatever you like. And if you are motivated, you would be completely it's amazing what you can learn from a keen interest in a topic and a library card. It's just phenomenal. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm certainly keen to provide an opportunity for my kids to be able to leverage their ideas, but the first step is developing those ideas. And to that end, that's the importance of education and support.
Apologies. I use those two cases, and you're right. I didn't just mean the finance side. I meant 100% the education, right? But how does the education, you know, begin? How do you get access to it? And some of the smartest minds I've ever met have essentially just bootstrapped. Like, their entire family, like, never went to university equivalent, and they decided, you know what? And the other thing as well is, I want you to grow great mentors. You know, you find someone in your life, you know, you might just read a book, a newspaper, you bump into a guy, a person on the street or a cafe, and you have those conversations. So just that network and the community around you, I think it's fantastic.
At the risk of getting a bit religious on you here, you have to keep in mind, I did spend a number of years in seminary, so I apologize in advance. But there is actually an ancient Jewish wisdom that says, if you want to become an expert in a topic, you've got to do two things. You've got to find yourself a teacher, and you've got to find yourself a friend. And I say that all the time when it comes to investing. You know, the first thing you've got to do is you've got to work out what your philosophy is and find someone that can mentor you. I mean, the value of a mentor is just indescribable. If you don't have someone to set you on the right path, then you can't even really start. But I think what's undervalued in the wider world is the value of a buddy. I call it an investing buddy, often in the quarterly reports that we write or in the communications we have with our investors. And, you know, just the value of having a compatriot, not someone who's smarter than you, not someone who's senior or junior to you, someone who's on your level, where you can battle out and test ideas, where you can challenge each other, where you're not afraid to feel like a fool when you make a mistake. You can make mistakes in front of them, they can make mistakes in front of you. And I was very fortunate that in developing this business, in going through my early days in the industry, I was able to meet Vass, who's now my business partner, where we're very comfortable, perhaps a little bit too comfortable, challenging each other. But what it means is, you know, it's very easy to lie to yourself. It's much more difficult to lie to somebody who isn't equal. And what it means is that you get much better outcomes. So whether you're a professional running a fund or whether you're somebody looking to get into investment for the first time, you know, the first step is you've got to work out what makes sense for you. For us, it's value investing. And I was very fortunate to find a mentor in Charles Leyland in my early days. But once you've established that, once you've set yourself on the right path, keeping on the path, finding a way to get emotions out of your decision-making, there's no better way than having what I call an investing buddy. It just makes a world of difference.
So taking that to Collins Street, because like we were discussing before, you know, how essentially that all works, you know, with the families, the buddies. And I think the point I made before was teams make more money, right? And they have more fun doing it. Right. So who is in your team, you know, and what's the different skill sets they bring and personalities?
Yeah, look, life is always much more fun with a partner. That's for sure. Look, I mean, we've grown a little bit recently. I think at the moment we've got two full-time analysts being Vass and Steve. And we've got myself, I would call myself part-time analyst or portfolio manager, part-time business operator. We've got one guy in compliance. And we've got two people in distribution and also somebody to help us with the day-to-day operations. So we're a much bigger fund now, or a much bigger business, I suppose, than we were when we first started. When we first started, it was myself and Vass and Anton, who we brought on as a compliance and strategy fellow. But certainly things are much more fun when you do it as part of a team. You know, people say, oh, so there's only three people or four people in your stock picking team, in your investment committee meetings. And I say, well, I mean, technically that might be true, but, you know, the whole office is made up of grown-ups. The whole office is made up of people who understand finance, who are passionate about investing, who are passionate about value investing. And so the other day, for instance, we found ourselves having a conversation about how could we, on the one hand, have the massive uptake in dietary drugs like Ozempic, and on the other hand, have big growth expectations for a company like ResMed, which does sleep apnea and somewhat is reliant on people being overweight. And it wasn't just me and Vass having the conversation. It wasn't even just me, Vass, and the other analyst having the conversation. The entire office got involved in this conversation, trying to work out how you can have, you know, a J curve in both Ozempic and essentially in ResMed. And when it came down to it, I think the difference in opinions could come down to who has faith in humanity and who has less faith in humanity. Who believes that people can be trusted to do the right thing, and who believes that people can be trusted to be lazy. And I think a lot of life comes down to that sort of question. But ultimately, I suppose it came down to we couldn't come to terms, and ResMed got put in the too hard basket. But, you know, oftentimes we'll find that Vas and I will both start at a different place but end in the same place. So, you know, for instance, we've got a material stake in gold stocks within our portfolio. We've even got a special situation fund that specifically invests in gold stocks. And when Vas first brought the idea to me, we don't make any changes to the status quo unless both Vas and I can agree. And when he first brought it to me, he was pitching the idea that there were a tremendous amount of tailwinds for gold, the commodity. Now, as is often the case, Vas turned out to be right, even though I disagreed with him at the time. And I said, look, you know, I hear the points you're making. I hear that production is down. I hear exploration is down. I hear that investment's up and central banks are buying more gold than they ever have. But gold prices have gone from 1,200 to, I think, 1,800 bucks at the time we were having this conversation. I'm happy to invest in gold stocks, but I don't want it to be reliant on gold prices going higher. And so rather than just taking a massive macro view on what gold might do, we tried to pick the eyes out of the investment thesis, and we picked stocks that didn't require gold prices to go higher, but instead would do quite well if gold prices even stayed where they were. And that's often the case. Again, Vas has a significantly different background to me, but we are both deep value investors. And so ultimately, it tends to happen 90% plus of the time that if I bring an idea to him or he brings an idea to me, eventually, even though we might come at it from different angles and even though our journey from point A to point B might be quite different, we do tend to end up at point B together and in agreement. So, yeah, look, I mean, the importance of having a team around you. Again, it's all well and good that it makes things more fun, and certainly you can leverage it. Certainly people are better qualified at one part of the business than the other, and you can leverage that for sure. But, you know, I've seen plenty of times people who are far smarter than me who have launched a portfolio, bought into their own story, and then with the benefit of hindsight, when you look back, when they look back, they can see the glaring mistakes that they made or why they might have been, you know, massively overweight in a particular position, being driven by how they felt about the business rather than the dynamics of the business or the fundamental valuations of the business, and then they get themselves in trouble. If you have people around you, they keep you honest. Certainly it's nice to have a team around you that are all experts in their field. Going back to the genesis, you know, when Vas and I first launched the fund together, we both imagined that we'd be picking stocks and managing the portfolio together. And we quickly realized that you can't run a managed fund business where both of us are doing the same thing. And so very quickly we had to come to terms with one of us being a better stock picker. Sadly, that wasn't me. And the other being better at some of the other aspects of the business. And we had a separation of duties somewhat. Fortunately, we did quite well in our first couple of years, and then we were able to bring on somebody who was key on distribution. We had Anton there as compliance. But to the extent that we can outsource all the things that aren't our core competencies, that's what we've sought to do since we launched. So I would rather that Vas spend 100% of his time picking stocks and managing the portfolio. He probably spends about 90% of his time. I would also like to spend much more time doing that. That is what I love. I do get excited about finding a great new idea. But the stage of the business that we're currently at, I'm probably spending about 60% of my time running the business and 30-40% of the time being over the stocks and having these enjoyable arguments and these wild and wonderful stories about the different sorts of ways we go about doing our research.
I'll say it again. Teams have more fun and teams make more money.
That's it. More fun and more money. Those are equally important when you're running a business.
Equally important. They go hand in hand. With the philosophy, we kind of been discussing it, but it should cover this to get a bit of a direct understanding. What is the philosophy, right? Because we've mentioned a number of companies. Like I look at the holdings that are in the portfolio. A lot of them are Australian centric, but then you discuss Ozempic, right, which is not essentially on. So hypothetically. It does the portfolio, and then there's a whole bunch of resources, infrastructure. Is it a go anywhere strategy? Do you have the complete ability just to go, you know what, dollar's not in our favor, as an example, what was it when Julia Gillard came in and she announced the super tax, and you went, okay, right, there is no more profit in this because essentially it's at its apex. This thing is coming off. Do you have the capacity just to go to asset out? I know you're bottom up, but do you look at things based as an asset class and you go, look, resources isn't where we should be right now. We should be looking at a different asset class, or how do you think?
You certainly can't be blind to what's going on in the wider world, and that will influence how you pick stocks. But, you know, ultimately we are Australian-centric because our mandate is to invest in Aussie equities. That's our flagship fund. Anything else that we've done, and we have done some other funds that have had global exposures, but that's been by way of research we've done for the Value Fund. We found an interesting idea. We wanted to invest in it. We're investors. We thought perhaps some of our investors would be interested in coming along as well. And so we've opened it to the public, and then we've launched a second fund. But we've never sought to launch a new fund just for the sake of launching another fund. I suppose the heart of your question is, what are we trying to achieve? You know, we're value investors. And the way I see that is that we're looking to buy a dollar worth of earnings or assets for 50 cents. Now, that might sound obvious and great if it does, but I say to distinguish ourselves from people who might invest in an asset that's worth a dollar today and they're happy to pay a dollar today for an asset that might be worth $2 or $3 or $4 in the future. That's all well and good, and plenty of people have made plenty of money doing that. That's just not how I suppose we play cricket. I think there are two things that are essential when it comes to investing. Number one is you want to make an adequate return. And number two, and again, I think this is equally important, you want to be able to sleep well at night. And what we like to find, what we love to find, what we're passionate about are finding stocks that are cheap based on the current status quo, where the market is either emotionally disinterested in the company or the company is flying under the radar. And I suppose the challenge, you know, I think value investing, I think Buffett has previously said, you know, it's simple but not easy. And in trying to find what we call that information advantage, you've got to do some weird and wonderful things from time to time. You know, I think Rob's mentioned you've got to do what other people won't to achieve what other people don't. And, you know, some of the stories of our research, while I think it seems pretty straightforward, time and time again, we hear from our investors and from the people who are speaking to in the broad industry that for some reason, the wider investment world isn't doing the sorts of stuff that we're doing. And what we're doing is not particularly complicated. You know, I remember one of our earlier investments in the fund was in Metcash. You know the Metcash business? Yeah.
Yep.
Basically, for anyone who doesn't know the Metcash business, they're essentially IGA. If IGA does well, Metcash does well. And for some time before we were looking at it, the company had just been in the doldrums. It had fallen, I think, from $3.50 down to about $1.60 or thereabouts when we started to get interested. And we reached out to management. Management were telling a pretty interesting story. They were saying, look, guys, listen, market, we're turning this around. It's not just that we're going to turn around. We've already started turning around. We've recognized the problems with IGAs, and we've implemented some strategies to fix it. And if you stick around for the next 6 or 9 months, you'll see that what we've done has actually worked. And again, I don't know what your experience is shopping at IGAs, but the three strategies they came up with were, number one, price match. Certainly, I historically had always thought of IGA as being the more expensive place you'll go if you can't get to a Coles or a Woolies.
So did I.
And yeah, they said,
in my mind, that's what I think it is. It's the more expensive version.
If you go to the proper sized IGAs, they have a ongoing price matching policy where they'll identify everyday items from Coles and Woolies and they will match those prices. So number one, let's not be thought of as just the expensive alternative if you want to get specialty items or if it's convenient, number one. Number two, again, I don't know what your shopping experience is, Murdoch, but some of those IGAs are gorgeous. And some of those IGAs are, let's just say, not so gorgeous. Similarly, some of those IGAs are run by fantastic operators, and some are just, you know, one store, one operator, and they do the best they can do. So they came out with three strategies. Number one, they were going to price match. Number two, they were going to pay to refurb stores in sort of like a JV with the store owners. So it wasn't a loan. If you went in $100,000, Metcash would match you for $100,000 to refurb your store. And then they went and they retrained a lot of staff to get best practices throughout the whole network. So, you know, you read the broker notes on the one hand, and they will assure you that Metcash, you know, you can't run a supermarket business through a franchise model. You listen to management. Management are telling you that, hey, guys, you can. And if you just stick around, you'll see that we are. So, you know, we're sitting there wondering, how do we know if the market's right, or how do we know if management's right? And from my understanding, again, I took a bit of a unique journey to funds management, but the way I understand it certainly is that in the brokerage world, in the stockbroking world, the brokers don't really get access to management, And they basically make their decisions. And Murdoch, you can correct me if I'm wrong here. Their decisions and their guidance is basically off the back of guidance from the analyst. And the analyst has access to the companies. Is that about
so
right?
So it's essentially, it's analyst in-house. But there's the firm I was at, there's a problem with analysts in-house when one analyst only does finance, one only does resources, one only does industrial, one does tech. Because what happens is when that particular asset class is out of cycle, they will still pitch their favorite business as that's going to be fine in 2 years and write a 42-page document about how amazing it's going to be in 12 months. Meanwhile, the money's not there. The wind is in the sail. The MACD, the technicals is not looking great. The thing will still come off and hurt you even though it should be going up in 3 years, right? So that's a problem. The other place where we got information.
I think what you're saying is it's not their absolute favorite ideas. It's their favorite ideas within a guideline.
They don't have the ability to go anywhere. You know, they've been given they're doing the best they can within the slice of the world which they've been given. But unfortunately, the pie is a large piece. They're just given one slice. So we take that information. Then you know you get access to Reuters, Iris. You know, on the data side, we did have fund managers coming in, hence the reason I do these now, because I find this fascinating. And the only real access we had to companies was when essentially the company was looking to raise equity, do a convertible note, or essentially. So the problem there becomes they're coming in and pitch to need money. So essentially it just becomes conflicted remuneration. You essentially is coming in and saying to someone, hey, we'll pay you a 3% stamping fee to potentially do an asset class that might not be the best fit right now.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't, you know what I mean? It's an issue.
How is that reason? I do
stockbroking right now purely because there's a lot of people that have, you know, Commonwealth Bank shares that are legacy or, you know, have a CompSec account for retirees. But I say it as a stepping point to running wealth correctly, which is essentially an asset allocation. I do it in order to help them on the journey, but I don't like it as well because it's conflicted remuneration because you're purely charging a client on the transactional in and out. And once you get paid, you sell $2 million, you buy $2 million worth of stock, you know, selling NAB or buying Westpac for no reason, purely just to pick up a 40 grand ticket. You know what I mean? Like, I've got big issues with the broking industry to an extent, but
I'm not casting aspersions and I wasn't asking the question to be negative towards the broking world, but just to make
But they do point, have a place.
Well, no, certainly they do. Certainly they do. My point is that neither Vass nor I took that route. Both Vass and I have run and operated and eventually moved on from companies. Companies that have been quite successful. Vass is, again, more successful than mine. But the way we view shares is that it's a share in a business. And I want to do the sort of work that I would do if I'm looking to buy a whole business, if I'm looking to buy a meaningful amount of shares in that business. So, you know, back to the Metcash example, I'll put it to you, Murdoch. I'm sorry to put you on the spot here. But if you're trying to work out if management's right or the market's right, as a guy who's making investment decisions, what can you do? Or what would you do?
The only logical explanation I would have is look at what the competitors are doing, find out who's top three in the industry. Look, I think it's like fund managers, right? You know, who is the best right now? But it's also past, present, and then looking at the future. So one model used to work in the past, but then you need to look at the regulatory changes. I call it one door opens, one door closes, like the Julia Gillard thing. She puts in a super tax, you know, and then essentially the entire industry is dead. So if regulation comes out and makes things more attractive, and again, what's their other business model? Like, you know, Woolworths, their main competitors, have gone the McDonald's model, where essentially they're not necessarily targeting the revenue component. They're essentially major property players. So the other question becomes, you know, what are the big players doing right now? What are they looking at and why are they doing it? And then the other question becomes as well, where's trends going? So right now, a lot of people have health problems. In the current things with the new regime shift, I think in the Senate they were discussing, one of the guys made a comment, he goes, when you go shopping, have you ever noticed that where you shop for groceries, IGA or Woolworths or whatever, it's got a health food section? Ask yourself a question. If it has one aisle that's a health food section, what does that say about the rest of the food that they're selling, right?
That's hilarious.
Let that sink in for a second, right? Yeah. There's a reason why we shop at Harris Farm and other, you know, places that, you know, what's it called, farm to table or whatever, to try to get away from a lot of the things that have given myself and my kids and family health problems. So the other one as well, which I'll be looking at, is on the behavior side. So essentially, you know, not from a money standpoint, but, you know, what are people starting to do? Like there's a bigger culture now. I think people are discussing schoolies. That's something ridiculous. Like 50% of kids going to schoolies don't just drink and have a great time anymore. They're going on fitness and gym and climbing mountains. What I'm saying is the behaviors of the people coming through for the next 10 years will be different to now and different to the past. So, and remember, I'm 38 now. When I was 24, was I thinking this way? Absolutely not. But it's just, if you ask the question how I would look at it, I would look at it based on a whole, not necessarily just on the specific, that business in comparison to A, B, and what's coming from C.
I'm loving this because what you're giving me is an insight into the institutional world of investing that I've not really had the exposure to. You, it sounds like, are far smarter than I. I'd be very interested to see your models and come have a chat over a coffee at some point.
No, but, mate, I'm like Joe Rogan. I know 70% about everything and I know nothing. I'm speaking to you guys to learn. I just ask questions.
Let me tell you what we tend to do with these sorts of things. We get out on the road and we ask the questions to the people at the coalface. So with Metcash, we picked 15 stores in Greater Victoria that were early adopters of these initiatives, and we'd rock up unannounced. We'd introduce ourselves to the checkout person and ask for directions to the manager. Again, we'd introduce ourselves to the manager and just strike up a conversation, ask how business has been going since they implemented these new policies and these new systems. And you would be equal parts surprised and somewhat horrified by how much information you can get when you express an interest and passion and you're talking to people who themselves are interested and passionate about an idea. And I remember one time we ended up spending half an hour, 45 minutes with the son of the owner of the biggest IGA franchise in Australia at the bottom of a staircase that led up to a pizzeria, just near the entrance of his IGA, talking about how it's been going, how the network sees it. And he gave us a sort of feedback that was invaluable. I remember we were talking and he said, you know, management have been speaking about rolling out this program over 18 months, but at their recent, I think it was annual or biannual conference where everyone comes together for a bit of a junket and a catch-up. He said the feedback had been so overwhelmingly positive that he would be surprised if it wasn't rolled out across the whole network in 6 months. So again, you know, if you're happy to get out from behind the desk and you go ask human being questions, it's quite amazing how much information you can get. So across the 15 stores we visited, the feedback was almost identical. There was one shop that I would exclude from that. There was one shop where we turned up, introduced ourselves, got pointed to the manager or alleged manager. He was checking prices in the aisles. We didn't think he was a manager. It was a beautiful store and you could see the offices were actually upstairs, but whatever. We thought we'd introduce ourselves and then hopefully get put in touch with the right person. He took offense to our questions. We think he thought that we were competition, but he physically escorted us out of the store. So that was a little bit confrontational for me and more than what I was used to, but certainly an interesting learning experience. But you know, we went back home and said, you know what, management aren't just telling stories. This is actually happening. And the share price, of course, fell from $1.60 to $1.40 to $1.20 to $1. I think it bottomed out in the 90s or something. And as an investor, and I'm sure everybody listening to this have had this experience, you know, if the only thing you've got to judge your investment decision by is what the share price has done, then to see a fall from $1.60 down to, say, 95 cents can be incredibly, incredibly frightening. But if you know the story and you understand that the market just doesn't get it and that if you wait, you'll see the eventual outcome come through, then you can be confident not just holding on but even averaging down. And that's what we tend to do. You know, the vast majority of our transactions aren't in new ideas. It's in buying more of the stocks that we've already got when the market is not really fully appreciating them. You know, we did similar things when we looked at the Reject Shop. You know, when we were looking at a company that had a hair tonic, this is a funny one. You know, there was a company that had a hair tonic slash shampoo that promised to thicken and regrow your hair. And I know it sounds like the script from a movie, but this was legitimately what they were pitching. And they had the scientific studies and they were swearing black and blue that this thing works fantastically. And so we thought to ourselves, well, how are we going to go and work out if this is true or not? We went to the local pharmacy that sold this particular product. We We bought 10 bottles of the shampoo and we distributed it to our follically challenged family members who, for the next couple of months, had to send me via WhatsApp a fortnightly report on how their hair was going. The shampoo was great, but the investment didn't pan out for us. We didn't invest in them. But, you know, we're just looking to try and do that little bit more than what the broader world is doing to get that information advantage and then take advantage of that. And it strikes me every time. Every time we go out to these shops and we you know, we visit and we speak to people and we ask, you know, have you had other fund managers come? Have you had other brokers come? Is anybody speaking to you? Inevitably, the answer is always no. And it strikes me as strange that people who are making investment decisions in businesses aren't getting out there to better understand the underlying businesses. And that's what we're trying to do. We're just trying to get out there.
There's many different things I want to discuss and understand and mechanics and everything as well, but let's keep going in this. I find this fascinating because I experienced the exact same thing when I was back in the broking days. Specifically, it was around BHP and also specifically when the saga came out with Newcrest Mines. And what I think the price came off and no one could understand what was happening. But then what I found out and what I realized is nearly every single analyst in the industry who were all great analysts, what they were doing is because one thing people need to understand is access to information, right? If you don't have something and then all of a sudden you get a particular terminal, right? And then all of a sudden you get access to that terminal and that terminal spits out data, which makes your life easier, more efficient, right? Which is now what we're seeing with ChatGPT. It doesn't mean it's right. What happens is something becomes faster and more efficient. And that these days it was the Bloomberg terminal. People forget and they don't understand that essentially those numbers that are put in are essentially consensus numbers. And everyone's doing their modeling based off consensus numbers. No one actually has the time or whatever it is to physically go out and check the numbers. You know, is this the number of ships coming through? Is this what he's saying is correct? Are the weather reports correct? So everyone's building Excel spreadsheets because you just press a button, pull out a bunch of data, run your analysis, and then essentially write your report based on that. And I think that's what you're discussing. No one actually gets off their bum. Oh, no, that's not true. Not no one. Not a large percentage of people get off their bum and go have a look. And okay, I'll give everyone a reference that people understand.
It's a structural problem now. I mean, the point you're making is that no one's going out there to do price discovery.
But I'll give everyone a fun one. If anyone watches Billions out there, God, Billions is a great show. What's that chick's name with the bald head that's I can't remember her name, but she's practically went out, came back.
Taylor,
absolute legend. So in one of the last episodes, she's bought every bit of electronic machinery that was essentially a sale of the local JB Hi-Fi. She brings it back into the office and everyone just hears this noise, this smashing. And everyone's like, what's going on? She's got a baseball bat and this girl is thin. She's not a strong chick and she's just beating the living crap out of all these machines. And everyone's like, what are you doing? And then she's got a stack of data chips, like of processing chips right on the table. And then she drops some ridiculous statistic and she goes, did you know out of all these machines, 86% of them just come from the one company? And then like five or six people in the room and then the penny just drops.
Yep. I mean, that story is a great story because anyone can go buy those smart devices and do the same thing that Taylor's done, but people just don't do it. People just don't do it. And I don't completely understand why. Look, maybe it's an institutional structural issue with the way people come through the system. I don't know. Maybe it's the sort of people that tend to be attracted to investing in numbers. Aren't also the same sorts of people that would have the personalities or the will, the drive to go and actually interact with the wider world. But I can't tell you how many times just chatting with my wife or my kids about a particular idea has driven our investment decisions. I mean, I recall a number of years ago when Myers had a really tough time and the brokers were all finally coming around to it. And Vass and I were having the conversation. I said, look, I mean, it's all well and good that we're looking at all these numbers, but as you said, all of these numbers are broadly consensus numbers. And if consensus numbers are based off consensus numbers, well then, you know, what's the real value in there? I said, let me just go have a chat to my daughters and my wife. And all I did was I went and I asked my daughters on the Sunday afternoon. I said, hey, do you guys want to go shopping? Yeah, that would be great. Let's go shopping. I said, do you want to go to Myers? And two a T, all of them said, no, thank you. Not interested in going to Myers. So you can tell whatever turnaround stories you want. But if the teenage girls and the young mums aren't going to shop at Myers at the time, things might have changed since then, but at the time that was the case. Then, you know, how much confidence can you have in the EPS or the general earnings growth profile that's being pitched by management or the brokers? So, you know, there are plenty of books out there. There are plenty of value investors that talk about it. But I think one of the books that best sums it up is One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch, which basically just suggests if you keep your eyes open in the wider world, you'll find better ideas sooner than Wall Street will. Because you'll have a better insight into the actual underlying businesses. And it doesn't seem like a complicated concept. But again, you've got to be prepared to get out there and do the work. And, you know, we say all the time within the office, we've got to get comfortable being uncomfortable. And I try and teach the same thing to my kids. Yeah. Again, a bit of a tangent here, I apologize. But, you know, I remember during the COVID lockdown. Murdoch, are you Melbourne based or are you Sydney based? I didn't catch.
Sydney.
Okay. So you don't understand the emotional toll that we suffered here in Victoria.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. Let me tell you,
it was a journey. But we owned for quite some time at that point a company called National Tire and Wheels. They were and are, I think, still the largest distributor of tires and wheels to Australia and New Zealand. And Vass and I were trying to work out from our home detentions what we could do to try and work out if the market were right and the share price fall was justified, or if the market was wrong, and it wasn't the end for tires and wheels. And, you know, we couldn't work out what to do. And we agreed that we'd think on it. We'd talk again later in the day, we'd talk again the next day. And I hung up the phone, and literally almost immediately, there was a knock on my door. It was my then, I think, 14-year-old daughter. And she came in and she said, look, Daddy, I apologize to interrupt you. I said, no worries. Hiya. Love you. Glad for the distraction. What's up? She said, look, we've got a class and a project where the teacher wants us to work out the effects of COVID-19 on local businesses. So I had a light bulb moment. I said, you know what? I've got a perfect job for you. I said, you and me are going to do research together. We're going to call a bunch of local tire and wheel shops and find out what the impact of COVID-19 has been. Now, the market at that point, the stock market, was pricing National Tire and Wheels as if there was like an 80% wipe out of earnings going forward. So that was the starting point. They were trading, I think, at about 50 or 60% of their inventory value. So it was trading very, very cheaply at the time. So we agreed after much arm twisting and debate that she would call 2 and I would call 6 and then we'd share the information. We did it on speakerphone, but we'd share the information. She'd go and write her assignment and I'd make a decision in terms of whether we should buy more or whether we should bail out. So we called around and the feedback was pretty much the same across both her calls and my calls. The industry was down about 30%. It was the worst I'd ever seen ever in their career. But again, being down 30% isn't the same as being down 80%. So I walked away with 2 lessons that day, maybe 3 lessons. The first one was, number one, it wasn't as bad as the market thought and there was an opportunity to be had here. Number two, the Western world doesn't properly appreciate the value of child labor. And number three, random people who you don't know are far more prepared to give their time to a 14-year-old girl calling about a school project than they are to give their time to a fund manager looking to do research on his equities portfolio. Not surprisingly, a couple of weeks later, when the company came out with their update said they were down 30% and the share price rallied very, very aggressively. So we were fortunate we were able to almost double down at that point. And my daughter was very fortunate that she was able to get an A on her assignment. But look, again, it's all about doing that little bit extra, and the leverage returns you can get on that little bit extra are sometimes just amazing.
I love that. I love every single thing about that. Why don't we just quickly cover off some of the mechanics? I normally do go through this in the beginning, but God, it's been an interesting conversation. Okay, so you have how many funds underneath Collins Street?
Look, the flagship one is the one that gets all of our focus. We have a couple of offshoots that have come along the journey. All of them are closed except for our gold fund, which is occasionally open. But we manage around about $350 odd million across the suite of funds. About 220 of that is the flagship fund. We've got a gold and precious metals fund, which is still live. We've got a offshore oil and gas services fund, which is in wind-up. That was a three-year lock-in. Investors made about 90%. Most people have taken all of their money off the table and recognized that return. A few people have expressed an interest in sticking around, and so we've extended that by another year, but that's essentially in wind-up. A convertible notes fund, which is in also closed, and a small joint venture on a PE fund as well, which is also closed. So our main game is the value fund. It's currently, like I said, about $220 million. And based on how we invest, based on our concentration, our focus, we think that we've got capacity constraints once we get to about $400, $450 million. And we'll have to work out what we do after we get there, but hopefully we'll get there soon.
What are the minimum investment, the management fee, performance? When do you pay the distributions, the monthlies? What are the mechanics?
Well, it's a unit trust. So we distribute every year all realized capital gains and all income. The distributions have varied quite broadly. I think if you take the average over the last 9-ish years or so, you'd probably find it's around about 3 or 4% distribution per annum. But in terms of return, we've run around about 14-ish percent since inception. And over the long term, I think over the last 12 months to the end of October, it's been a good period, obviously, with US rate cuts and Chinese stimulus promises. I think we did about 23% for the last 12 months, around about 13% for 2 years, about the same, I think it's about 13.25% for 5 years, and almost 14% since inception, which is coming up to 9 years now. In terms of management fee, it was actually a contentious point when we first launched the fund, and people told us we were crazy and that it wouldn't work and that we couldn't sustain a business doing this. But, one of the lessons I learned through the GFC was that clients appreciate our performance, but they don't like paying fees for losses. And I hark back, I remember one of many conversations I remember during, I think it must have been 2009, maybe 2010. It was probably 2009. I was meeting with a client for a coffee. And I think at that time the market was down some 25%. And his portfolio was down about 5%. And I turned up to this meeting expecting a ticket tape parade, pats on the back, congratulations and introductions to all of his friends. But, while I'm sitting there, all this particular client was interested in was discussing why the portfolio was down. And I said, his name was Peter. I said, Peter, what do you want from my life? The market's down 25%. We're down 5%. And he said, Michael, I appreciate that you beat the market, but I can't eat relative returns. And that sort of stuck with me. And so when we launched the fund, when we were looking to launch the fund, one of the key things for us was we wanted to build something that we'd be proud and happy to invest in ourselves. And we took a look at the standard way that the finance industry charges fees, and we just thought that wasn't very fair. So we don't charge a fixed management fee. We only charge a fee based on performance, only if we generate real performance. So it's subject to both a high watermark and also a benchmark. The benchmark rate is the 10-year government bond rate, which at the time when we were first having these conversations was around about the 5.5% mark. Our view is if we don't do well, we ought not be asking for full freight and fees. And if we do well, then we've found that our client base are happy to pay and happy to pay very well sometimes. Again, it's not everybody's cup of tea. I think certainly entrepreneurs and heads of businesses, family businesses, it's really, really resonated with them. When we speak to the institutional investors, it's certainly in the early days, there was a lot of pushback and a lot of concern. I think over the last 8-9 years, slowly, there have been other funds that have come out doing something similar or perhaps offering it as an alternative to their standard freight and fee approach. And so people are getting more comfortable with it. But yeah, our view is if we don't generate a return, we ought not get paid. The worst that'll happen is thank God I come from a big family. My children can suffer from hand-me-downs for a little while. And in an absolute worst-case scenario, they can have toast for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But we have an exceptionally lazy balance sheet and haven't got there yet and hopefully never will.
I appreciate that. I've had this conversation numerous times about how you're getting remunerated. And my sister's the head of remuneration at Sydney Water. Numerous other fund managers, mates. I've seen it with my own career. you'd probably agree from what you just said that how people get remunerated essentially dictates behavior.
Absolutely.
And why I love that entrepreneurial path is a lot of families which we deal with have businesses or where it comes from. And when you can't rest in your laurels, the one comment I hate the most, and maybe I sound like your client, right, was as an advisor is when I speak to, say, other investors or fund managers, and then the market did crack in 2021 and it was brutal. I found that the key tagline that they went with is, oh, you know, we're still beating, market. We didn't perform as bad as the market. Or they went back to our historical performance of is X. And I'm thinking to myself, that doesn't help the 75-year-old that's, you know, in these markets for these particular outcomes. And I suppose that, as they could say, you can never put an old head on young shoulders. But that definitely dictates how I personally invest. And now a lot of families which I speak to, it used to be grow, then protect. But right now it's protect and then grow. But there's different ways of doing it. But what I like about it, having conversations with people like yourself, is I like to understand how all these asset class work, how you think, how you work. And then one thing we haven't discussed, which we'll get into now, is macroeconomics. And then looking when particular regime changes happen. You know, the past 4 years were different to the 4 years before that. And now we're seeing it's been very much globalist the past 4 years, you know, changing policies, doing things. Now with the regime change, we're seeing very much a nationalistic focus start kicking off with Hungary, Poland, the States, a lot of, you know, ground roots, you know, pushing back on various things and starting to ask questions. Why Australia's got an election coming up? But I suppose it's very interesting to hear different perspectives on, you know, have you got a go anywhere strategy? Can you essentially, if the US dollar, the Aussie's going to weaken, can you go US? You know what I mean? Like, how do you, if you're essentially can only allocate in Australia, you know, how can you position the portfolio to, I suppose, protect and grow?
Look, I mean, protect I can answer. Grow is a more complicated question, I suppose. I mean, you know, our general approach is to buy a dollar worth of assets for 50 cents today. So that's quite, I mean, it's not easy. It's simple. It's not easy. That means that we're finding ourselves buying companies on extremely low price earnings ratios, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. And it means that we're buying companies with net tangible assets, saleable equipment or whatnot, that's worth a premium to their, to the value of their current share price. So that's how you can protect for starters. And that's, we believe the rule number one in investing is protect the downside. You know, don't lose money. It's a bit like Fight Club, right? The number one rule of investing is don't lose money. The number two rule of investing is don't lose money. But I mean, our general view is that if an investment only makes sense in certain circumstances, it probably doesn't fit the bill for our portfolio. Again, I mean, we've got a flexible mandate in so much as we can hold as much stock as we want. We can hold as much cash as we like. We can be in whatever sectors we like. We're very focused in so much as we're very concentrated into our favorite ideas. And I think that also goes some ways to de-risk our investment. And like we said, you know, we try to provide a fair offering by aligning our interests with our investors. But in terms of the impact of the US elections or potentially the Australian elections, I think generally speaking, if an investment idea only stacks up some of the time, then it doesn't fit our mandate. I'm fascinated by what's going on globally, both in Australia and America in particular. But in terms of how it would dictate how we invest, not so much. I mean, we were fortunate, I think, in that we have a fair amount of exposure to traditional energy and traditional energy services, which will presumably do quite well under a Trump government. We also have a fair amount, like I said, gold exposure, which I thought would have probably done much better than it has done since Trump got elected, but you know, markets are fickle things.
That's what happens when everyone holds gold and Bitcoin.
Shit. I don't know. It's hard to explain. I don't know. But look, I mean, in terms of policy, in terms of government, I think it's a bad idea to base your investments on those things that are out of your control and unreadable. In terms of macro drivers, things like, you know, more buying from central banks, a decoupling from the US dollar as a reserve currency. Those sorts of things have a fundamental impact on certain commodities and certain trading globally, and that might have an impact. But broadly speaking, we're pretty boring. I mean, we're value investors. Our bread and butter is industrial companies in Australia. Every now and again, we venture out to something like commodities if we see, you know, a very clear and distinct opportunity. But we're not trying to pick what interest rates are going to be. We're not trying to pick who the next government's going to be. We're just trying to find good companies that are misunderstood and trading so cheaply that even if things go against us, the downside is so minimal.
Right, because that's what I want to get my head around a little bit, because you made the comment that you're not really heavy on the commodities. You normally go, you know, business by businesses, right? But I was looking at the presentation that came out today, and it said significant portfolio holdings, Beach Energy, Boom Logistics, Carnivore Energy, Catalyst Metals, Humm Group, Litigation Capital Management, NTAW Holdings, Remelius Resources, Retail Food Group, Seven West Media, which is quite interesting. You're holding a, and then again, West Gold Resources. So you do have a lot of resources exposure in the portfolio.
So we bought about 20% of our portfolio in gold stocks, and that's reflected in some of those stocks you read from that list. We do have a stake in Beach, although it's much, much smaller than it was a couple of years ago. The largest stake or the largest position we've got in, I suppose we'll call it the dirty word, fossil fuels, is our position in Carnarvon. And I do think that the future is not as dour or as broken as perhaps mainstream media might have you think when it comes to fossil fuels, especially gas. I mean, I don't know how you make an argument for a transition to renewables without gas and really nuclear energy playing a part of that transition. But let's set that aside. So Carnarvon has exposure, obviously, to oil and gas. But you don't need the oil and gas exposure to make Carnarvon work. I mean, Carnarvon's got 18 cents worth of cash or cash call against the current, I think, share price of about 16, 17 cents. They've also got assets that are worth probably on the low end, easily another 15 or 16 cents based on transactions that were done in the last 12 or 18 months. So, you know, to make an investment in Carnarvon, for instance, and this sort of goes to my point, we don't want to rely on the commodity to go up to be able to profit from the underlying stock that we're investing in. Not a lot has to go right for a company that's trading at 17 cents against 30 or 35 cents worth of cash and saleable assets to see the share price go higher. Now, there's obviously complexity. I mean, if it was simple, then the share price would be trading at a premium or at its intrinsic value. You know, with Carnarvon, for instance, the problem was previous management were threatened to spend their cash that they had raised for the development of their core project, which is a offshore oil and gas project off the coast of WA, tier one jurisdiction, very tier one asset, probably the biggest undeveloped discovery in a generation anywhere in the region. And they were threatened to spend it on tier two projects in tier two jurisdictions. And so we were a major shareholder. They came to us, they pitched the idea to us and said, hey guys, don't spend money you need on projects you don't need. Stick to your knitting, cut costs, focus on Dorado, don't waste your money. You know, to the extent that you can influence Santos, who's the major JV partner, try and push them to go forwards. But your job is don't waste money, cut costs, and that's your whole job. They came to us a second time with an idea. We said, again, guys, don't use the money that you need on projects you don't need. They came to us a third time, at which point we said, okay, guys, you know, three strikes and you're out. We reached out to some other fund managers who had material holdings. We agreed to where we'd like to see Carnarvon going, which is basically cut costs, don't waste your money, and see if you can monetize the assets. And then we reached out to management and said, guys, we think it's time for you guys to move on. And what we found historically, you know, with large companies, I think it takes a very special kind of human being to fundamentally break or ruin a stock. Yeah. We've met some of those special individuals, certainly over our journey, but it takes a very special effort and a very special individual to ruin a large cap company. When you move into the mid cap space and the small cap space, you are very much reliant on management as much as you are reliant on the assets. And in this particular case, management owned less than 1% of the stock on issue. And over the previous, I think, 2 or 3 years, they'd raised about $205 million, to which management themselves had contributed a grand sum total of $15,000. And so it was very clear that their interests weren't exactly aligned with ours. We understood the, I suppose, institutional imperative to get bigger, especially if you're getting paid a salary rather than being an equity owner. But we said it's time to move on. And so we put in a new board, we're very hands-off. We don't really want to get involved in activism. Certainly, we don't want to get involved in running a business. But the people in there now, including one of the directors of one of the other funds, have cut costs by 40%. They've promised not to spend any money on anything other than their core business, and they've hired bankers to market and sell their assets. So I think the broader market is still confused by what the timeframe is. You know, how quickly can they get Santos to come to the party? But broadly speaking, management now are doing all the things that you could possibly want them to do. And it seems to me like it's unlikely that with the management in place now and the upside prospects that they're likely to be trading at these sorts of levels forever. I mean, that just makes sense. Again, I'm cognizant that this is going out wide, and I'm not offering financial advice to anybody. But my suggestion is that if you can find a business that's not reliant on the macro, but can also benefit just from the micro, from the company specific goings on, then that's ideal. If you can get the macro tailwinds as well, fantastic. But we're always looking from the bottom up. We're always looking to make sure that on their own steam, the company is worth more than what the current share price is. Does that make sense? Yeah, it does.
And the other thing you touched on, which I think we've touched on numerous times, is how do people get remunerated? Because how you get remunerated dictates the behavior.
Of course. The other thing we're seeing is, show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcomes.
Who said that? Sorry?
I think it was the Charlie Munger-ism.
Yeah, it sounds like it. The other one as well is, I've seen it time and time again, resource companies, is that numerous resource businesses are phenomenal engineers. These guys can pull ore out of places you didn't even think there was ore. But because they've been, they're also very good salespeople, a large portion of them. And because they've been on the warpath and they get a large, you know, amount of cash, for people that don't understand mining's a difficult game because you have an idea. You need other people to finance it. And you may have found yourself in a scenario where it could be 2 years or 20 years where you're poor, you're broke, and you have no capital. And you go down this path trying to raise, and then finally you get a large chunk of money like that, $200 million. There's this thing about money when it sits in your pocket.
Burns a hole in your pocket.
It can make you go mad, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing as well, as you mentioned, you know, if you're getting a salary or whatever, you need to be seen to be doing things, is how people think. And human beings have a very short mind and they don't have patience. If you've got $200 million sitting in your pocket and assets are, you know, I think what gas hit, 2019, $9, now it's back down, natural gas is down at $2. And you need to do a deal. That is not a good time to do a deal. You know what I mean? I'm just using that as an example, right? And then And essentially that changes behavior and then essentially outcomes.
I have sympathy for their emotional state of being and what drove their decisions. And that's all well and good, but just don't do it with my capital.
I couldn't have said better myself. No, I'm very heavily invested in, been a long time, helped do the seed and in essentially the Beetaloo Basin, Tamboran. If you want to talk about a story where it's exactly what you're talking about, but essentially the problem isn't necessarily the board or the company. Mm. They're fantastic. Mm. The issue is essentially fiscal policy and, you know, government policy, you know, within Australia and just the inability to access it. And then so much so, that's taken an asset which was Australian domiciled, which would have paid tax into Australia, and forced that asset now to be licensed in Delaware, the states, and we're going to lose all that revenue. It's just madness when... To your point before, you know, energy and gas, there are some industries and some products that we need for farming and whatever that you cannot create without having natural gas. Like, it's just, I often wonder again with geopolitics whether or not a lot of these policies are actually designed by foreign players to essentially weaken us for other alternatives. And yeah, if the regime didn't change, what's happening in the States now, it'll be a very interesting landscape. Might be speaking a different language.
Look, I don't know. I think there is a cultural shift, certainly in Australia as well, when it comes to energy. I know that energy still seems to be a bit of a dirty word. And on the occasion that I drive to the office, which is about once or twice a week, I still see those signs saying end fossil fuels, you know, stop oil, whatever the complaints are, to end fossil fuels. And, you know, as I drive past these people and see them in their puffer coats and synthetic clothing, you know, I can't help but wonder, do they actually understand that everything they're wearing and all their signs are probably made out of some derivative of oil? It's besides the point. But But
no, I think that is the point. It's kind of like, you know, when people are tweeting about, you know, don't use plastic and straws and dolphins in a phone that essentially has got, you know, full of everything known to man. Plus it's got cobalt in it, where something ridiculous like 70 or 80% of the cobalt comes from the Congo, which is essentially, you know, artisan mined. If people don't know what artisan mining means, that means bare hands, bare backs, babies on the backs, right? You know, and essentially through a huge number of various entities and shell companies, you know, big institutions, even Apple, whatever, they buy the stuff from them, the Google phones. People just seem to want to be seen to care, but then at the end of the day,
if you care about ethical investing, then you should have a problem with cobalt for sure, and several other minerals. But I mean, even something much more simple than that. Think about the emissions generated in mining something like copper, which is needed in everything, technological. I mean, the process of getting from, if it's doable, and I'm not sure that it is, but if it's doable to get to a fully renewable future, the cost from emissions, from an emissions perspective, between where we are now and where we need to get to is just astronomical. Just astronomical. Not to speak of the inflation that it tends to cause. Again, I would like to see the world move towards cleaner energy. I think that it is the proper view and approach to take. But to suggest for a second that A, it's cheaper, or B, that it's going to be clean to get there, is just to be dislocated from the reality of the world.
Yeah, no, we're just talking, and it just reminded me of a company that another fund manager told me about that I've just been paying close attention to, where things happened in the past. It was a very dirty process. You lost a bunch, and now they've changed it. It's essentially titanium. Have you been following Iperion X at all?
No.
Okay.
Tell me. Sounds like it's an interesting story.
No. They just changed the I'll do a terrible injustice. Iperion X titanium. So current process with titanium loses 80% of the material. And then the current process, you can't take scrap and then convert it into something else. This new company has got tech that essentially has the ability to break it down like into a powder form and then essentially use hydrogen gas to reforge into everything from a frying pan through to satellites and titanium. So they can
for better recovery or for recycling?
Both. So they can recycle. They're the only one right now that can recycle what currently exists. Plus, once the scrap runs out, they can go mine to manufacture. Yeah, I was just wondering if it came across your...
No, I mean, but you see the impact. If you've got the technology to recycle properly, you can see the impact it can have on a commodity. I mean, you think now about the, I don't know if you can call it strength or, but certainly iron ore plays a big part in our international trade, and people think of iron ore as being, you know, something that will be there forever, certainly as long as China's growing. But that's because China creates their own iron. Almost 100% of their iron is new iron that they have forged. If you look at a country like the USA, I read the other day that greater than 60% of the iron that they use in projects is recycled iron. So if you're recycling iron, you're not going to need iron ore. Certainly not in the volumes that you're doing right now. So, you know, it's very interesting how dramatically a sector could potentially, or a commodity could shift, if you have a way to either improve recovery or recycle. And you saw that a little bit, I think, as well during the deep trough in the uranium markets. I don't know if you followed them. You know,
I've been following. We made a lot of money out of the uranium, and then we got out before the most recent turn, which was kind of lucky. Just looking at technologies on the MACD, just saw the golden cross go through, and we just go watch this go by. But yeah, everything that's happening in France and everything looks fantastic. But you know, yeah, Australia just can't catch a bid.
We were probably in and out before you. We were probably in and out before you actually invested. We first invested in 2017 when spot price was at $18, and that was against an average cost of production globally, including the super low cost of, you know, Canada and Kazakhstan. Canada and Kazakhstan are the two biggest producers in the world, and Kazakhstan has a low cost of production. But even including the lowest cost production producers, the average global cost was $45 against a spot price at the time that was $18.90.
And that was coming from Cameco from Canada.
Cameco is Canada, correct. Correct. But their cost of production is much, much higher as well. And it was able to get so low because energy at that point was so cheap that companies were able to generate significantly better recoveries and sell that excess uranium at rock bottom prices. Now, the market sort of naturalized and neutralized a little bit since then. And now you've seen uranium prices go up, I think, as high as $80 per pound quite recently. We got in 2017. We sat on our thumbs doing nothing for about 3 or 4 years, and then got out after the first big run-up in 2020, 2021. So using Paladin as a proxy, we bought it in, I think, at an average price of about 8 cents. And then when it got to about 55 cents, we said to ourselves, what's this worth? And we did like a DCF. We figured that it's reasonable to expect uranium prices long-term to be 70 to 80 bucks. And on that basis, we thought 55 cents was about right, and we got out. Almost precisely after we got out, within 2 weeks, the share price of Paladin went to 75 cents, and within a month it was at a dollar. So we left a ton of money on the table for the next guy. But I imagine that we were in and out before you probably came in. We were very early adapters and probably too early, and early exiters, again, probably too early. But such is the life of a value investor. We're early in and early out.
I do like the analysis quite a lot. We spend a lot of time and resources, which I love. I can't help myself. Again, broking's fantastic because with the stockbroking model we come up with, if anyone wants to learn about miners, start in a stockbroking firm because essentially it's raise, 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 and you learn a lot. Mm. But where I didn't have that much, upbringing knowledge in is, you know, companies that are already ingrained or mainstream. So I'm very curious is why you have Seven West Media in the portfolio, considering we're now, people would say, look, we're doing it right now, the podcast generation, right? You know, some of these just individuals running a podcast, doing a YouTube video, they're getting more eyeballs, more revenue, or just more interesting topics. Like, you know, it's just two blokes having a chat or two girls having a chat, you know what I mean, in a room, and there's essentially no filter. And, you know, there's not like – the other great thing about long format, we've been going for, nearly an hour and a half, but what's great about this is – imagine being in a conversation where the single most interesting part of the conversation happens right now and you go, you've got 2 minutes to answer. I've got a lot of friends that
work. You've got to keep wanting more. Isn't that the premise for every hook in every TV series ever?
Yeah, but what happens if I don't speak to you again for another 2 years? You know what I mean? Like, you know, I'm just using that as an example. So I'm very curious as into the thesis behind, you know, Seven West Media or like a mainstream media style business.
Look, I mean, Seven, it all comes down to valuation. So, you know, I think the business is deeply, deeply misunderstood by the broader world and fairly so, I think. I mean, you know, when I think of media or traditional media, it's not hard to think or to understand why people view it as, I suppose, yesterday's news. Pardon the pun, I suppose. You know, when my kids, again, I've got 6 kids, they range from 8 to 18. You know, when my younger kids are looking for entertainment, they're not switching on the TV to watch whatever happens to be on. They're going to YouTube or they're going, God help me, to TikTok or one of these other services where they can, you know, where they can access and interact in a way that they can't interact and access through Channel 7. And my older kids, similarly, you know, they'll be on Instagram or they'll be on Netflix or whatever the case may be, rather than going on to Channel 7, because you can pick whatever you want to watch, you can watch whenever you want to watch it. But Channel 7 is more than just what we think of as traditional media. It's not just Channel 7. It's also all of the digital assets, and it's also their newspaper assets, particularly the Western. And I think people don't appreciate that it's still a cash cow. Certainly, they have been the number one advertiser in the market, I think, 4 years running now. They have reached to over 90% of the Australian population. And I think they own about 41% of the advertising dollar for that market. So they're the number one player by a long, long way. And I think people underappreciate the value of maybe 3 things that they do, and they do better than anybody else. Although, as I started to see, Netflix is potentially going to become a competitor in the future. But local news is number one. Local programming is number two. and sports.
I was about to say sport.
Massive drama. Yeah. And especially on the digital platform. I mean, I haven't turned on my TV in forever, but when the Olympics were on, I was logging in to the digital channels like you wouldn't believe. And Channel 7 views that as their future, I believe. It now represents, I think, better than 40% of their earnings and has grown at an extraordinary rate over the last few years. And in recognition of that, what they've set up is, I think they call it the Phoenix platform, which basically tries to do what all of the mainstream social media companies do, which is give advertisers the ability to pinpoint target their audience. So just like you can say, I want to send my ad to everyone between 20 and 40 on, and you know, who follows whatever sports team or earns between X and Y. And you can shoot out those ads on Facebook, or you can shoot those ads out on Google. They're doing the same thing now on the Channel 7 network, that they can very, very specifically target their clientele through those digital offerings. And I think sports in particular and the digital offerings have a lot to offer. But you know, you look at the business, they've cut costs by 30%, I think, in the last year. They bought back, I think it was about 5 or 6% of their shares, recognizing how cheap they are. And they're trading on 3.5 to 4.5 times what I would say is trough earnings. I mean, you know, people talk about how the economy is doing just fine, but I think if you speak to the regular guy in the street, that's not how people feel. I think if you look at a per capita basis, I think we're probably in the 6th or 7th quarter of actually negative growth. So I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that we're probably at or near trough earnings for the advertising market. Yet even on those trough earnings, it's trading at 4 times. And to my mind, that makes it probably the cheapest advertising company, certainly in Australia, possibly in the world. And that's attractive to us. It's not sexy. It's not exciting. But it's a cash flow generating machine that the market just hates. And, you know,
it's interesting how people look. My brain sees patterns. That's why I like the fund managing universe. So it's more pattern recognition, just see where things go. So you look at the numbers component. What I heard from what you just said was platforms that do well offer a product which you can't access anywhere else. And I'll give you a very good example, right? I hated Optus with a passion, especially after all the big scandals and everything like that. But I keep paying $25 a month. Why? Because I am a Premier League and, you know, international football absolute enthusiast, right? And it blows my mind that, you know, the Socceroos, or that, you know, whenever their games are on, aren't on Optus, right? They're actually, you know, on a mainstream network. I think it's Channel 10, right?
Yeah,
so what I'm finding, what Australian networks have done is they still have managed to capture the Australian sport component. Yep. Yep. And as a byproduct, people will still have that app installed on their television, you know, 7, 9 or 10, purely for a specific event. But then as a byproduct, they might accidentally go, oh, I didn't realize Dancing with the Stars, I've been saying that. Oh, is it still trash? You know, I want to have a look at that or whatever it is. You know what I mean? And then you look at it, you watch an episode, and then you catch a couple of ads. You know what I mean? What I'm saying, I think they've done a great job there.
Trash is the best-selling stuff, but you're right. I mean,
it's very interesting.
I view the world through the prism of my experiences. So for me, something like having the rights to the AFL for the next 5 years
is
very, very powerful. My wife, not so much. She might be more interested in Farmer Wants a Wife or I don't know, Dancing with the Stars or whatever the case may be, but each to their own. And again, we're not betting on return to the heyday of free-to-air television. We're simply suggesting that it's so cheap right now that even if you rebase your expectations substantially, it's too cheap.
Yeah, but the other benefit as well, I can't remember the company's name, but it's actually happened in the past 12 months or 18 months. There's a company out there that's has the ability to actually target those ads. It's only just recently come out. I can't remember the name. Do you know the name of the company? Because Netflix is starting to use it. There's a particular company that will help a network take the data of who's watching what and then specifically.
I mean, that's the Google and Facebook model.
Yeah, but why it's really interesting now is Netflix ran the model where they would never charge ads. But then in order to bring back ads, the only way they were palatable is if the consumer would actually be given something that they actually wanted to see so they wouldn't switch off. So why I'm finding that interesting that mainstream's adopting that I think the biggest problem that I ever had with mainstream, I just didn't want to see Hungry Jack's every day. Like, it just, you know, I just didn't want to eat Hungry Jack's. You know what I mean? Like,
I'm the kind of weird guy that will change the channel if an ad I don't like turns up. But
thank you. So I think what's being very good with culturally as well is that if you can give people what they're at least half interested to see, they won't change the channel, which is very interesting as well.
Fascinating. Interesting.
Anyway, yeah. Michael, we've been going for a long time. I appreciate this. It's very interesting to see all the insights and everything and how you guys guys and girls manage money. Is there anything, any thoughts that you want to leave people with?
I guess I'd say if people are on the journey, and I think you made the point earlier, everything is more fun to do as part of a team or with a partner. And I think that is true. But I would suggest even more. I would say if you're looking to start on the journey, you've got to find a way to be honest with yourself and set yourself on the right track. And to do that, you've got to read a lot, for sure. You've got to find yourself a mentor. I mean, the importance of finding a mentor, just I can't understate it. And then you've got to find yourself an investment buddy. It might be your brother. It might be your cousin. It might be an old classmate. You've got to find someone to help keep you honest. And then, yeah, if you do really well, reach out to us through our website and we'd have to have a chat, I suppose. If the next Warren Buffett comes about thanks to this podcast, please be sure to call out to Collins Street Asset Management before you reach out to everybody else. Keen to have a chat.
I love that. How can they reach you?
Look, the easiest way is through our website, which is csvf.com.au. So it's an acronym for Collins Street Value Fund. There you can find our reports, our podcasts, our interviews. And then you can also reach out to us if you want to pop by, meet us when we're on the road or meet us in Melbourne. That's the best way to find us.
If anyone wants to follow you and keep track of you on all the standard social media platforms, LinkedIn and such.
We're on LinkedIn, but that's about it. Like I said, we're pretty boring value investors. We don't have a lot of social media reach. We're focusing on what we're good at. And sometimes that means some other aspects of the business might be lacking. But yeah, you can certainly find us on our website and through LinkedIn. Either way would work.
Brilliant. Michael, thank you very much for coming on The Rate of Change, and I hope you have a great day.
Murdoch, it was my pleasure. Looking forward to doing it again sometime soon.
Sounds good.
Any views expressed in this recording do not represent the view of any other third party and are the sole personal opinions of the speaker. Any reference to financial product does not constitute advice or recommendation, and before any action, you should seek proper advice from your financial professional. Australian listeners should head to www.moneysmart.gov.au to find more information on obtaining financial advice. To get in touch with York, head to our website www.yorkwealth.com.au.